what it seems to me, your conclusion that reason is foundational is the point that I want to draw, try to put in a, I want to open that gap and say that it's not foundational, but reason shows up, it exists, it's shot through everything that we as humans do and how we operate in our world, but that doesn't make it necessarily foundational. That makes it an element, and makes it elemental, but not the only thing that exists as an element in human existence, the only aspect of human existence. There's, to call back something a little bit earlier in the conversation about how, I think, Chris, you were saying about how we don't have to know with absolute certainty that something, you know, is going to be the case in the future in order to act on it rationally. We still have a sort of rational approach to these things have existed before, therefore I'm going to act in a certain way to try to produce something that's happening in the future. That is a rational action. But it seems to me that if reason, if rationality has any definition at all, then that definition is certainty. That it's evacuated of all uncertainty. So to say that something is probabilistic is to certainly say that there is some rational aspect to it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be more likely than something else. It has to have some degree of rationality. But there's some aspect to probability that is, if not irrational, it is irrational. That it is to say that there is something happening in existence that is mystical, that is mysterious to us as rational beings. And to act at all, to conjure within ourselves the compulsion to choose to act on a world that is fundamentally mysterious to us, a future that is fundamentally mysterious to us, is to conjure an act of faith out of ourselves. To say, I choose, despite my lack of knowing, to act nonetheless. To produce, and come what may, I am acting on the world. I feel like there's as much of an element of mysticism shot through all of humanity as much as there is an element of rationality.
I mean, there's a lot to untangle there, I suppose. I mean, when I say that reason is foundational for Marx, I mean that his ability to elaborate the inner nature of capitalism, as he puts it, is done on the basis of reason. Like, the insights that he has when he's claiming to have insights into the essential nature of the logic of, and obviously logic is almost, is synonymous with reason, of capitalist production, comes from his adherence to some notion of reason in some sense of the word. I mean, also, it's worth noting that when Marx and Engels talk about the dialectical structure of history, or of nature even for Engels, right, which I think Marx even himself agreed with in many ways, this is coming from Hegel, who is using dialectics as a basic synonym for what reason itself is. So I guess I would push back a little bit on this and say that I do still stand by the claim that reason is really foundational for Marx. Now, obviously, as, you know, finite human beings, even though we have reason and can use it, we're not omniscient, right? That's not, I mean, it's a false dichotomy, I think, to sort of set it up such that either we're omniscient and know everything with certainty in advance of how, you know, our actions are going to impact the world and all that stuff, or it's just a leap of faith that we're taking. I would actually venture to say that, you know, we have to calculate our actions probabilistically sometimes, because, okay, of course, we just don't know all the variables. In principle, we could know those variables, but as a finite person, you're not going to know all of the X factors, whatever, that are shaping the situation that you're acting in. So I don't think it means that the situation is itself inherently unknowable. I just think it means that we, as human beings, are not capable of exhaustively accounting for the immense complexities in any given situation that we're faced with. I think the other thing to say, too, has exactly to do with this question of ends, right? Where, you know, I guess a question I would ask when it comes to this sort of example of acting in the world, as you're putting it in terms of faith, well, I would hope that the ends that we're acting on the basis of, that we're aspiring to, we might say, are not just accepted on the basis of faith. Like, I would hope that, you know, if we are fighting for, let's say, the cause of justice, that we're not just accepting that justice is a good end on the basis of faith, but actually can rationally redeem justice as a true end in itself that is worth fighting for, right? Even if we might err in attempting to realize it, we might be able to still give a good, you know, argument, rational account as to why justice truly is an end in itself that human beings should strive for in our lives. This sort of thinking about, again, ends in themselves, I think, is what is sort of most, let's say, at stake when it comes to this question about how we're understanding the role of reason in Marx's thinking. Because reason is not just what allows him to give an account of how capitalism works. Reason is also what allows him to speculatively, in Hegel's sense of the word, see what we should be doing for the end of human freedom, right? And I don't think Marx is accepting that freedom is this end we are seeking simply on the basis of faith. I think he actually would argue, no, no, we can actually rationally account for this. And, you know, some of his early writings even speak to this, like when in the Paris manuscripts, he's talking about our species being, or Gattungswesen in German, from Feuerbach. I mean, he's talking about freedom as really being bound up with our human essence. And for him, this is a rational foundation as to why freedom really is something we should be fighting for. Now, whether our particular action in the given moment helps us get to that end, or whether it fails and maybe even sets us back, well, of course, you know, reason is not such that we don't have crystal balls in our hands, right? And I would even go so far as to also add that the idea that we could predict the future like this is based precisely on a mechanistic version of reason, not a dialectical one, right? And this is the idea that reason is only synonymous with formal logic. The upshot of Hegel's thinking is that, no, no, reason is not just formal logic. It has to do with the content of the world itself, too. You know, looking at, I guess, a passage from One Dimensional Man that maybe would speak to the importance of this idea, there's on page 12 of chapter 1, if I could just quote from this real quick, there's a nice little passage that I think maybe highlights the significance of appealing to reason for the purpose especially of ideology critique in late capitalist society. So he says here, in the middle of page 12, and as these beneficial products become available to more individuals in more social classes, the indoctrination they carry ceases to be publicity. It becomes a way of life. It is a good way of life, much better than before. And as a good way of life, it militates against qualitative change. Thus emerges a pattern of one-dimensional thought and behavior, in which ideas, aspirations, and objectives that, by their content, transcend the established universe of discourse and action, are either repelled or reduced to the terms of this universe. They are redefined by the rationality of the given system and of its quantitative extension. Now, there's a lot to unpack there, but what I just want to emphasize is that what I think Marcuse is saying is that in late capitalist society, there's this, what he calls pattern of one-dimensional thinking and behavior that is always thinking within the confines of the status quo. And so this way of thinking is antagonistic to kinds of thinking that might criticize the entire status quo as such. And it therefore then becomes a question for us, well, how can we criticize the status quo as such? How can we think critically about this in terms that are beyond the status quo? Well, lucky for us, Hegel and Marx were actually already interested in this question, and for them, one of the insights of dialectics is to say that every given social system, every given thing even that exists, carries with it its own negation. And it's by way of reason that within the status quo, we can find the negation of the status quo and can think in terms of socialism or communism and things like this, the sort of society to come that we might want to strive for. And, you know, people like Marcuse and Marx would argue we should strive for. So reason becomes sort of vital for this project of thinking outside the boundaries of the capitalist system.
That definitely makes me feel like I need to read more Hegel. So,
well, that is the answer to every philosophical conundrum.
read more Hegel. Hegel.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I basically don't see any reason to not accept the basic proposition there. But I also tend to think that there are it doesn't matter that the people, you know, whose ideological hegemony, who have ideological hegemony over the pro-parliament faction in the English Civil War, it doesn't matter that they're actually like horrifically obscurantist in their own worldview, because they are clawing at the creation of a world which undermines it. So they don't have to have a conception of what will happen in a few hundred years, you know, in the French Revolution. And in the French Revolution, they don't have to have a conception of what will happen later with the Russian Revolution, as like these distinct ways of acting upon the world with, in order to like help birth the conditions under which those things can become realizable. So that there is a, it's like, it's good if you can, you know, it's better, right? If you're like super conscious of and can arrive at, by way of reason, the philosophical construct of socialism, but you don't have to in order to be an actor in it. In order to help actualize, or in order to help move along the process by which one might arrive at it, like it's Trotsky in Results and Prospects of the 1905 Revolution, that his, you know, and this is by way of reason that he concludes this, right? But he says, like, whether the working class comes to power in this country under the banner of socialism or under the banner of anything else, if it is going to rule, you know, in its own self-interest, it will necessarily be creating socialism. Which is to say that it's like self-conception and its capacity as a whole to reason is secondary to like what are its own objective interests as a class.
Yeah. I mean, I think the issue, however, that we're facing in like late capitalism, that I think, you know, the Frankfurt School is really trying to focus on, is the question as to why such a wide segment of the working class has basically sort of receded from, or moved, shied away, I guess I should say, from exercising its collective agency to try to transform things on the basis of their objective interests, but have instead internalized certain norms of behavior and values from the status quo that have made them complicit with the status quo, right? I mean, this is just a long-winded way of asking the question, you know, about class consciousness and whether the working class is conscious of itself as an exploited group in society that should do something about that, or whether that exploitation is veiled by, let's say, consumerism or by some of the material comforts that a more privileged segment of the working class in the first world have by way of the super exploitation of the working class of the third world or something right. Like this, right?
I tend to think that the sort of the overall thesis of one-dimensional man is a little bit less useful in understanding the like what we could call false consciousness, right? Like that we get from like a Lukács, that it's less useful than something like the Critique of Spectacle as a way of like presenting an image of the desired path of society in a way which is false. So like rather than being bought off by the consumerist, by the dogma of consumerism, I think there are at least times in which there are like objective conditions which are ripe for intensely radical confrontations with the powers of the state and of capital, and that there are times when people do try to participate as conscious actors in the world to try and shape the world, but in ways which are bequeathed to them by the society that they are struggling against, so that even arriving at what you could call like a more radical consciousness isn't necessarily like enough. And I think that there's a more complex and somewhat like living an autonomous existence as a way of social control than just make people happy or distracted with TV and products. Like, I think that that's an element of how, I think that that's even how the bourgeois society thinks of itself. But I actually think that I think that a lot of the present day left is engaged in a way of like consciously trying to change the world, but in ways which are like somewhat useless. And so it's not that Marcuse is wrong. It's just that I think it's like a piece of an analysis of society rather than like, this doesn't explain why there hasn't been revolution in the West, like on its own, you know?
So it's not exhaustive. Right. Maybe it's a part of the picture, but not. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I would also just add that we should, you know, remember, like good historical materialists, when these texts themselves were published, right? I mean, Marcuse wrote One Dimensional Man in the midst of the 60s, which of course was a tumultuous period in which a lot of, you know, conflicts, especially anti-colonial uprisings, were brewing and all that stuff. The civil rights movement, obviously, here, et cetera, et cetera. But it was also a period of time that was still in the wake of America's victory in World War II, becoming the sort of world hegemonic power, where there were real rising conditions of affluence for at least a decent chunk of the working class. Right. Now, obviously, you know, that does not efface the racist dimensions of this society at that time or to the present day, blah, blah, blah. But their standards of living were going up for a lot of working class people.
Especially
a matter of fact, in this
well-organized working class people. It's like unionized workers who have a history of struggle actually have it, you know, they get to a point where they've achieved a lot that can be lost. And it does, there's a reading of that you can definitely say it. In a certain sense, it acts on a break for the continuation of the struggle that got them there in the first place.
Absolutely. And so part of what he's thinking is, I mean, the dilemma that he's dealing with is, how can we critique a society that is, quote unquote, delivering the goods? Like, how does it make sense to any longer to critique a society that seems to be improving, at least in these crass terms, the material well-being of certain parts of the working class? And of course, Marcuse is saying, yes, it does in fact still make total sense to critique it. But he's trying to deal with this sort of problematic dynamic in which this rising affluence is effectively co-opting certain segments of the working class and making them amenable to the status quo because, you know, now I can afford a car, now I can, you know, watch football on Sundays, blah, blah, blah. And there's a greater degree of contentment with the established order. I mean, this is also getting to the sort of historical dilemma in the 60s of, you know, the radical youth and student-led movements, especially the anti-war movement, the disconnect from that movement from a broader labor-based working class movement. There were, of course, some bridges that were built, but obviously not to the point where there was a genuine sort of like revolutionary conjuncture that was created, right?
Right. But on the other hand, in France, at the exact same time, the exact opposite thing can be said, right? Like that it's actually like highly contingent upon a multiplicitous factors. And, it, you know, like I forget his name, but there's a Francis Fukuyama type infamy for a certain French sociologist in 1967 who said that, you know, the French worker who a generation ago might have joined the Communist Party in order to keep from starving today is like, looks at his well-stocked larder and his television set and can basically content himself with knowing that life is going to continue to get better. And that means there will be no more revolution. And of course, the next year, the French working class drives the government out of the country, seizes control of the factories in conjunction with the student rebellion, but also not like in some sort of auxiliary sense, but in a vanguard sense. It, of course, it doesn't achieve and hold power, but it is fundamentally the same society as the one in the United States, which doesn't have that element. So it's just to say that there are more contingencies than just the sophistication of propaganda and the availability of consumer goods.
Oh, I mean, no doubt, of course. But I would say, though, however, that the issue still, at least in my view, maybe I'm mistaken about this, but seems to me to be fundamentally the same in France, too, that you did, of course, have more working class participation in the 68 uprising than you did in, you know, the movements here in the United States. But it still wasn't broad enough to meaningfully contend for systematic change or for, you know, alternative forms of power in society. I mean, ultimately that, you know, whole sort of rebellion was sort of a flash in the pan kind of moment that lasted a couple of months, where the students really did, you know, much to their credit, I might add too, and I don't want to take away anything from the valiant efforts of working class people and students who made these efforts. I, in fact, think that they were incredibly noble and good endeavors to take on. But it seemed as though their sort of vision of how things ought to be and what change should look like, et cetera, didn't become widespread enough to create, again, a sort of genuinely revolutionary moment. It sort of got close. It certainly got closer than in the United States, no doubt. And accounting for those differences is maybe an important thing to consider. But all the same, it still didn't boil over, as we
sure.
Say,
I mean, yeah, I you could definitely make the case that we're just talking about the relative strength of a way of organizing society, and maybe it's stronger than the United States at the time, but still, in both cases, it's strong enough to withstand, you know, the opposition to it. So, which is to say, in a way,
yeah,
I guess you make a good point.
We talked about objective, subjective, and instrumental. What are Marcuse and Horkheimer getting at? Like, what do they think would be the ideal form of reason? Because I know they're not saying that subjective reason is wholly bad,
right?
Obviously, but they are saying
sure.
that instrumental reason is bad.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Am I remembering this correctly? So
what is the good reason?
And I don't know that. Well, Horkheimer, I'm less clear about. Marcuse, I think, sort of dances around this idea without exactly putting it in precisely these terms. But the good kind of reason is, I would just harken back to good old Hegel once more here, and say that, you know, for, you know,
it's the panacea
as,
for all of our philosophical
Foucault
questions.
Himself said, even if we try to escape Hegel, we might find him waiting for us at the finish line already anyways. For Hegel, right, the sort of upshot of his sort of rational way of thinking, what he means by capital R reason, has to do with overcoming the idea that subjects and objects are fundamentally distinct things in the world. Like, they are distinct, but they're
okay,
also
yeah.
unified at the same time. I mean, this is part of the contradiction here that is fundamental to dialectics, right? That there's distinctions within a unity. And so, I guess I would argue that the kind of reason we should be fighting for would be unifying objective and subjective reason, actually, in a sort of holistic way that saw them as sort of two sides of the proverbial same coin. Where, you know, reason, in fact, does have to do with how the world itself really works, but it also has to do with our capacity for agency in the world. And, you know, the kinds of ends that we utilize our agency for can be rational or irrational, right? You know, Marx, in a letter to one of his early, collaborators Arnold Ruge in 1843 has a nice little quote where he says, reason has always existed, but not always in a reasonable form, which is sort of a strange, paradoxical little statement, right? But I think it actually kind of gets to the point here where the idea is that reason really is objectively a part of the world, but the way we as human beings subjectively have responded to it hasn't always itself been fully rational. And so what a truly rational society would look like would be one where we are sort of reconciling ourselves with the objective world. So this has to do with the sort of critique of alienation, ultimately, in Marx, right? Where part of the problem with capitalism is that we are, to put it in some metaphysical language, divorced from objectivity. You know, if you're a working class person, what you make, you don't own. What you do, you don't decide. So your actions in shaping literally the outside world are divorced from your subjective agency. And it seems as though, for real reasons, that this world is alien, external, and hostile to you. This also can be related to alienation from nature that we've talked about, where nature is just regarded as, again, just dead matter that, you know, we don't have to consider as a subject itself. Well, a sort of richer notion of reason, again, what Hegel would call speculative notion of reason, would be reconciling these opposed poles. For Hegel, there's always three moments in the dialectic that you could boil it down to. He says this at the beginning of, in the introduction to the Encyclopedia Logic, where he says there's the moment of understanding, which, crude nutshell, allows us to distinguish different things. There's the dialectical moment that then understands things sort of in contradiction with one another in terms of this developing contradiction. And then there's finally the culminating speculative moment that is based on the resolution of the contradiction. And I think really, you know, the notion of reason that I would just advocate for metaphysically and even politically is one that emphasizes especially this latter moment of reconciliation with the external world, where nature is not viewed just as an object or just as a subject in, you know, early animistic days, but as both.
Right, it's not like it's not like a terrifying power that we just submit to.
Yeah,
like, you know, like there's a storm and we'll pray to the storm gods for it to go away.
Yeah, you know, certainly just not advocating for that again.
No, but there is something about that sort of, you know, whatever, call it a primitive way of knowing, which is, you know, it is still a recognition of the natural world outside of your immediate control as something other than just raw material, right? It has, yep, has its own processes and we're related to them, and it has its own power, and it is wholly indifferent to man, right? Or to human beings, but it doesn't make it like God. It just makes it another another set of organic processes, just like human civilization is. And in fact, they're intrinsically linked.
Absolutely.
It's the rupture between those two, right? It's the metabolic rift that is the basis of alienation of man from nature.
I want to read this Horkheimer quote real quick. It says, if by enlightenment and intellectual progress we mean the freeing of man from superstitious belief in evil forces, in demons, and in fairies, in blind fate, in short, the emancipation from fear, then denunciation of what is currently called reason is the greatest service we can render.
That's good.
Yeah. The emphasis there, though, being on the phrase, what we call reason, right? And that issue here is that what we call reason and what we're even almost spontaneously inclined to think of as reason is not reason in the fullest sense of the word. It's a circumscribed version of it. And that's leading to all these sort of issues here, which I might add, on the other hand, end up then giving fuel to the fire of people who want to support a sort of irrationalist, you know, basis for politics or normativity. I mean, if you look at fascist thinkers, many of them have this, you know, genuine affinity for neo-mythological forms of thinking. And
oh, they're absolutely voluntarist and vitalists. Yeah. They have like, yeah, overcoming physical odds with strength of will. Mm. And like harnessing the mythical spirit of the race or whatever. Yeah, yeah, it's a very big part of fascism. Yep.
And, yeah, you know, this is almost like a sort of reflexive reaction against a certain kind of reason. But, you know, again, the sort of socialist Marxist, in my opinion, at least, view would be to say that, yes, we should critique and deal with this circumscribed version of reason, but that we shouldn't do that by just rejecting reason altogether. We should move beyond it and dialectically negate, but also reappropriate the, you know, where subjective reason gets it right in part, right? We should just not treat subjective reason as the whole of reason. Whereas, you know, the move that these noxious people want to make is just to say, oh, no, reason, screw it altogether. Again, like you put it, it's all about, you know, the force of will in an irrational world and asserting the sort of mythological, whatever the hell, merits of the race or all the bullshit that those people believe in.
I would assert that rejection of reason outright is probably less dangerous than the, you know, capitalist positivism, because those people can't do anything without blind capitalist positivism leading us into their clutches. Hmm.
Right. Like, and also the Nazis, for all of their early, you know, anti-reason, still are, I was going to say they are victims, but actually it's rather that the world ends up being victims of that precise reason reasserting itself in the way that they actually run their, you know, state and, you know, try to launch an empire. And even like, you know, the Holocaust itself is like, I mean, this is the Frankfurt School as well, right? It's like it is one of the logical conclusions that the project of enlightenment can go, and in fact did go, right? There is a certain rationality to it. And obviously, you know, that doesn't make it good or moral or desirable or progressive or anything else. Right. But it is this, like, if the Nazis really were these like ultra romantic, you know, anti-capitalists that they put themselves forward as, you know, in their early days. I mean, of course, anti-Semitism is a feature of their thinking either way. But, you know, the war machine and the war and the Holocaust and all the other stuff are like actually the results of modernity and the application of Nazi rule over what modernity bequeathed to them, rather than a rejection of modernity. Because it would be an impossibility to do without the full utilization of all of the, not just coercive, but also the planning and productive apparatus of society.
I mean, the Holocaust, I mean, was what made it as grotesque and horrific, you know, an event as it was the fact that the techniques of modern industrial production were being utilized for the purpose of just outright destruction of human beings, like in a systematic way, right? And in a qualified sense, in a quote unquote rational way, in that, you know, the scientific rational techniques of modern industry were being used to do this horrific form of genocide and mass murder in a more efficient manner. And then, it did do it in a more efficient manner, like, you know, obviously.
Also, production. I mean, they utilized the populations that they were exterminating for production in a very Fordist manner.
Yeah.
While they were killing them.
And I would say that, like, you know, on the one hand, it's, you could say the death camps and the immense amount of resources and mental energy and planning and everything that went into it, you know, ultimately undermines the Nazi war effort, and so it's irrational. But I would say that that's a fairly heartless and not particularly useful critique of the Nazis. It's like, well, they were ultimately they weren't actually super reasonable,
right? Well, but I would I mean, I guess just to speak to like some of the points that Horkheimer, that we've been sort of dancing around here, has been making, or that we've discussed even, is to say, like, no, they were being irrational, but they were being irrational precisely in terms of this horrific, noxious end that was the animating the sort of project that they were engaged in that was fundamentally unjust, fundamentally against the end of human freedom, and all of these sorts of things. And, you know, again, with the more robust notion of freedom, I would say, no, we can actually defend, on the basis of reason, the idea that justice is an end in itself, freedom is an end in itself, equality even for human beings is an end in itself. And so the Nazis were utilizing, we might say, in, you know, this regard, rational means in terms of industrial efficiency and all that, not all that stuff, for irrational ends. And part of, you know, what Horkheimer, I think, is trying to alert us to is the fact that within the paradigmatic way of thinking that is popular in capitalism, we don't actually have a way on the basis of subjective reason for saying these ends are objectively irrational, because it's all about voluntary values and voluntary subjective preferences on this notion. And so reason has no claims to make about the ends we should be seeking. But obviously, as Marxists, you know, these thinkers, and myself included, would say, no, reason actually precisely has everything to tell us about the ends we should be seeking.
Just a point I wanted to make about, you know, the Holocaust real quick is I think that it fit entirely within the system of reasoning that the Nazis were using, because it, I think that it's, I was reading elsewhere about how the Holocaust didn't really divert that much from the war effort. In fact, it like turned quite a handy profit by like harvesting possessions and gold and everything from murdered Jews.
Yeah.
And they also had the trains, the deportation trains had like a really low priority on the railroads. So I think actually it really fit inside of their system of rationality. Like they were able to reason that being a just end, you know? But yeah, that, so I think that, like you just mentioned, ultimately that's not a good reason.
Right. And precisely because, again, because the end in question is itself profoundly irrational, right? And,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
The question is, okay, on what basis can we make those kinds of arguments? Well, I'm not prepared to give a full defensible argument here for that, exhaustively, but, you know, my point would be that actually we can give a good argument as to why genocidal behavior is goddamn irrational, right?
Right.
And when it comes to, you know, the Enlightenment, I guess I would just personally say, I mean, obviously you might disagree with this, and others have disagreed with this, but that what Horkheimer and Adorno are emphasizing is a certain dimension of the Enlightenment, namely aspect of domination, where the sort of Enlightenment was in a way consumed with our ability as human beings now to master the forces of nature and dominate the world using our reason, right? They're emphasizing this element of domination in the Enlightenment, where, you know, by way of reason, we can dominate the forces of nature and can use them for whatever ends we see fit. But of course, you know, as we've been discussing, the question of what ends we should use this newfound power for in terms of science and technology becomes one that we can't rationally figure out on these terms, at least. Well, while I think that there is a fruitful way of talking about this problematic side of the Enlightenment that is warranted, against the sort of pessimistic account that Horkheimer and Adorno give in Dialectic of the Enlightenment, I would actually favor personally their student, Jürgen Habermas's account. He has a nice little article called Enlightenment, an Unfinished Project. And I think actually this, in a way, I mean, I don't agree with everything Habermas has to say, to be clear, but the ethos of this...
Well, that's good.
Yeah. But the ethos of, I think, this thesis in particular is one that I do agree with, namely the idea that we shouldn't be rejecting the Enlightenment as being totalitarian in nature and solely in the interest of domination. Rather, we should recognize that it's our failure to carry through fully and adequately the hope and project of the Enlightenment that is precisely the root issue of our world today. Because at its onset, at least, the Enlightenment was in fact concerned with questions of ends, questions about freedom and justice and all these sorts of things. You know, think of Rousseau's thinking as a sort of characteristic Enlightenment philosopher in this regard, at least. I would argue that it's only by pushing ahead with the project of Enlightenment in a consistent way. So that is to say that these, you know, regimes or figures that are using reason for the purpose of domination or servitude or genocide even, are not actually living up to the Enlightenment ideal. I would say that, you know, the project of socialism and general human emancipation and freedom ultimately is in the service of carrying forward the Enlightenment to its true rational completion.
Well, right. It's that the parameters that exist for the continuation of the Enlightenment project are too restrictive, because capitalism is a series of fetters on human freedom, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, yeah, I mean, sure, I think there's a reason why there's this notion of the modern socialist movement as the continuation of that project, and why we see so much to admire in, especially in the French Revolution, but in the whole period of what we call bourgeois revolutions, because they at least gave us the language of freedom, right? But then, you know, it can't be fulfilled even within
Absolutely.
The world.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, especially living as we are in this, I mean, I don't know how else to put it, tragicomic sort of political moment in the United States, especially with this, like, cartoon villain president and all this. I mean, it's interesting to just note that, you know, one of the sort of popular, well, popular is maybe the wrong word, but one of the issues I think that has come to the forefront in our society here is precisely the issue of relativism, right? Where we're in a quote-unquote post-truth era, where, you know, Donald Trump can just say things that have no basis in reality, but his supporters will nonetheless spread the word, believe every word he says, et cetera, right? And I guess I would argue that precisely in this moment where the very ideal of truth itself has been, you know, sort of radically called into question, this is a time in which it would be quite important for us to double down on the significance of truth, double down on the significance of the project of Enlightenment and these ideals. Because I think, you know, the contradictions of relativism and, you know, instrumental reason and empiricism and positivism are just playing themselves out for us in real times. And I think, you know, certain schools of thinking that, of course, have gained a foothold in the academy, like postmodernism, are also demonstrating for us their inability to actually think through the contradictions of the present moment in the interest of overcoming them. And so I would, again, reiterate Habermas's idea here that we should be trying to complete the project of Enlightenment, not rejecting it altogether.
Well, that's the, you know, whenever we, in previous discussions, when we have sought what is useful in, you know, the sort of romantic movements against modernity, is even in the present day, it's not necessarily to overcome, you know, that which was given to us by the Enlightenment, but rather to recapture the humanist essence that, you know, capitalist domination has beaten out of the project of the Enlightenment, so that the dialectic between, like, romance and reason it's not completed, right? And so, like, the romantic critique of modernity has to be raised again on a higher plane, not like to overcome and to obliterate science, but to re-impregnate science with history by reasserting human agency and the quest for freedom and fulfillment and all of these intangible things, which are, you know, romantic nonsense to the hard scientist, or at least the hard scientist who is enthralled to a bourgeois ideology that he doesn't recognize exists. And so
absolutely.
Our romanticism is a bending of the stick, to take an old, you know, an old term that I think everybody in the Cliffite tradition would like to never hear again. but it is a useful way of thinking about things if you don't use it as a bludgeon to tell everybody that no matter what you're doing, you're just bending the stick, however contradictory you're acting. But I think it's like, just to say that I agree with you, that there is something about like rescuing the project of enlightenment and trying to complete it. But one of the tools in doing that is found in the critique of enlightenment itself.
Mm. I would absolutely agree with that statement. Absolutely. And, you know, there's a nice little, I guess, just maybe somewhat to this point here, quote that in the Horkheimer that I think speaks to the inability of the scientistic empiricist way of viewing the world here, their inability, that is, to think in terms of these humanistic values, where he says, the statement that justice and freedom are better in themselves than injustice and oppression is scientifically unverifiable and useless. It has come to sound as meaningless in itself as would the statement that red is more beautiful than blue, or that an egg is better than milk. And his point here is just like,
I do think an egg is better than milk.
Yeah. But his point here is that, you know, in this sort of relativistic empiricist era, we don't have a foundation on those terms for a claim like justice is better than injustice. Right?
Right.
That requires appealing to something, again, more metaphysical in nature, less empirical. And that's what's sort of been lost in this one-sided, we might want to call it, part of the Enlightenment project.